Talk Show.
Recorded live.
Good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to Talking Twilight Zone.
You open this door with the click of a mouse. Beyond it is a world of sound, thought, and opinion. In-depth discussions of television's greatest blending of science, superstition, imagination. And you're invited along. For the next 30 minutes, we'll be talking Twilight Zone.
We hope you enjoyed the show, and to get things started, here is our moderator, Bobby Neer. Hello, Bobby.
Thank you very much, Lynn. Hello, everybody. My name is indeed Bobby Neer. Welcome to the inaugural broadcast of Talking Twilight Zone on TalkShoe. Who we are, where we started, and how we got here is the stuff of legend, at least to us, but here is the short version. For a good part of this year, since May, this program existed at another internet radio site, KSAV. About a month ago, they announced that they were ending their talk show format in favor of All Music, which is exactly what they did. And you can check them out, if you wish, at www.ksav.org to see what their new lineup looks like. And while you are there, you'll find a direct link right back here to us, just so you won't forget. Unfortunately, when that happened, that left us pretty much out in the cold. But thanks to hours and hours of searching and a little luck as well, we are back and are delighted to be a part of the TalkShoe family. The people at TalkShoe have been very good to us in making us feel welcome, and we will always appreciate the help they have provided. We are indeed honored to be here. With me now, just as they have been all along, are my co-hosts and three of the best friends any man could possibly hope to have. So please allow me to introduce them one by one. First, there is Kitty, who has been with me from the very start back in the early days when we were young and innocent and didn't know what we were doing, but still broadcasting a radio show devoted to the classic TV series, The Fugitive. Hello, Kitty. Welcome to Talk Shoe and the return of Talking Twilight Zone.
Hello, Bob.
Next, we have Ken, landscape gardener extraordinaire and owner of his own company, Life Gardening, in Vista, California. Hello, Ken. Welcome back to Talking Twilight Zone.
Glad to be here, Bob.
And last but certainly not least, Lynn, who was not with us in our fugitive days, but is quickly making up for lost time here. She's the one serving as host, keeping track of our chat room, and generally controlling all that we do here. Hi, Lynn. Welcome to our show.
Hey, good to be here.
We plan to be here every other weekend, mostly on Saturdays, but occasionally we may have to do Sunday at this exact time for the foreseeable future. All shows will be announced in advance, and any changes in time or date will also be announced. Now, what do we do here? Well, we discuss, review, and rate every single episode, in order of broadcast, of one of TV's finest and most memorable series, The Twilight Zone, created, produced, and often written by one of TV's greatest and most visionary geniuses, Rod Serling. 3.5 years, we did the same for TV's other great series, The Fugitive. Now we have turned our attention here. And since we have only done the first 13, we actually skipped ahead one in order to get a live call-in from Las Vegas. The remaining 143 out of 156 figure to be about a 4 to 5 year long project. So we hope you'll stay with us. About a month ago, The Twilight Zone and its devoted fans celebrated its 50th anniversary. A remarkable achievement when you consider that many of them were not even born when the series first ran on CBS. At a time when most TV series are lucky to last as long as 13 weeks, The Twilight Zone lives on in the form of DVD sets, TV marathons, and this radio program. If you would like to hear our take on that anniversary and some little stories about how, when, and why we became interested in The Twilight Zone, please visit our show archives at the bottom of our Talk Show page. This was covered on our very first show in May and can be found at the bottom of that list, along with all the other programs we have already completed. This program is also a spinoff of a very successful Yahoo discussion group, The Twilight Zone Revisited and Reviewed. Please visit our group site where we also review all of the episodes and run polls on each one. Become a member and join the conversation. Okay, enough setup. As they say in the fast food business, where's the beef? Well, we've got two episodes to beef about, but before we start our meal and our discussion, we turn to one of our lovely lady co-hosts, and that surely does not include Ken or myself, for a summary of each episode. And since we are doing two episodes on this show, we will hear from both of them today. So to get us started, here is Lynn with her summary and review of the first of two episodes today, number 13, The Four of Us Are Dying. Lynn?
Okay, Bobby. Well, thank you. The Four of Us Are Dying depicts the life of a man named Arch Hammer. Now, as Rod Serling says in his opening narration, Arch Hammer has been a salesman, a dispatcher, a con man, a bookie, a part-time bartender, and a few other things. He's a cheap nickel-and-dime man, in other words. But Arch Hammer has one amazing talent. He can change his face at will into any other face he wants simply by thinking about it. He checks into a hotel room with a batch of newspaper clippings and a master plan. The first identity or face he assumes is that of Johnny Foster, a trumpet player who supposedly was killed in a car accident. So Hammer decides to stop into the lounge where Foster used to play and seek out Foster's old girlfriend, Maggie. Now Hammer, as Foster, approaches Maggie in the lounge, and she thinks she's seeing a ghost, until Foster tells her that it was another guy that was killed in the car accident, not him, that he just decided to take a break and get away from everything. So after some passionate conversation and, you know, I love yous and all that, he tells her to meet him at the train station the next day, and they're going to run off together to Chicago. So, of course, Maggie's thrilled. She's thrilled to death because she loves him, and after a long, passionate kiss, she tells him so and that she's going to meet him the next day at the train station. Well, now he needs money to run away with this beautiful woman. So Hammer goes back to his hotel and chooses another newspaper clipping. This time it's a man named Virgil Sturrock, who was killed and whose body was thrown into the river after pulling off a job for a man named Pinnell. So Hammer assumes that, he assumes Sturrock's face, and he figures he's going to go pay a visit to Pinnell, and he does, and there you go, another person in shock that someone presumed dead is still alive. So Sturrock demands his cut of the money from the job he pulled off for Pinnell. Now Pinnell's scared, so he agrees to give Sturrock his cut, but Sturrock runs out with the whole stash as revenge for Pinnell having him thrown into the river to perish. So two of Pinnell's men run after him, chase him into a dead-end alley. However, before they can approach and kill him, Sturrock looks at a flyer hanging on the alley wall promoting a boxer named Andy Marshak. He quickly changes his face into Marshak's, and Pinnell's thugs are stunned when they realize that Sturrock has gotten away. So, you know, they're standing there, and they're looking at Marshak, and they're saying, well, you know, we got the wrong guy, and sorry about that, and they basically leave. Marshak, he's excited about, you know, the fact that they didn't recognize him, and he walks out of the alley. He passes a shop, and an old man approaches him. The old man says, Andy? Andy, is that you? Well, naturally, Andy is really Hammer, and he doesn't know the old man, so he says, no, I don't know you. And the old man tells him that he's his father, and that Andy broke his mother's heart and did dirty to a sweet young girl who would have done anything in the world for him. And Andy, he looks totally distraught by this, and the old man is yelling at him that he hates him, and he starts screaming at him. So Andy pushes him to the ground and runs off. Andy goes back to his hotel, and a policeman enters his room as he's packing. Well, he turns back into Arch Hammer, and the policeman attempts to take him in. So while they're walking out of the hotel, they go through a revolving door. Hammer takes an extra spin through the door, much to the officer's dismay, and changes his face back to Marshak's. The cop stops Marshak, says, did you see a guy go through this door? And Marshak says, no, no. And so the cop's now foiled. So Hammer's happy. You know, he's happy with himself. And he walks away from the hotel as Marshak. But then again, he runs into Pop Marshak again. Only this time, Pop Marshak has a gun. And Hammer begs with him not to shoot him, swearing he's not the person he thinks he is. But the old man shoots him and kills him anyway. So he's laying dead on the ground, and all of a sudden his face changes into all of the faces he assumed. From Foster back to Hammer, from Sturrock back to Hammer, from Marshak back to Hammer. So, as Rod Serling said in his closing narration, he was a cheap little man. And Rod Serling's right. He was a cheap little man, but he paid dearly in the end. I actually didn't like this episode. I didn't like The Four of Us Were Dying. I found it to be a pointless episode in that there wasn't a single person other than Foster's girlfriend, Maggie, that you really cared about. I mean, Arch Hammer has the ability to change his face and be anybody he wants to be, and he chooses three losers, two of whom died in an unsavory manner and one who would be killed by his own father. You never find out exactly what Marshak did to make his own dad kill him, and then again, you really didn't care. I only know I wanted this episode to be over as soon as possible. Beverly Garland's talent was wasted in this one. And they never show her reaction when she goes to meet him the next day at the train station, and he's not there. So to me, it was just a pointless episode that left me totally empty. I give it a big, lousy zero rating. And that's all I have to say about this one. So, Kitty, what did you think of this one?
Well, I didn't think it was quite that bad. But I gave it a 2 rating for average. It didn't really, I mean, it was one of those episodes that really didn't knock my socks off, but it didn't make me want to turn the TV off either. I mean, it was just kind of like, oh, okay, here's a guy who can change his face into these different people. And you're right, who does he choose to change his face into? He chooses to change his face into some losers. I mean, why not the President of the United States? And, you know, see if you can get some fringe benefits by doing that, or a famous movie star, you know, walk into a restaurant, you know, with the face of Cary Grant and see what kind of service you get. And you're right, the whole thing with the father, I mean, that seems a very extreme reaction for a father to have to his son. He says, you broke your mother's heart, and you broke the heart of a nice girl, but what exactly did he do that was so terrible that would warrant his father to take a gun and blow his son away? I mean, did he kill his mother? I mean, did he kill the girl? I mean, did he kill anybody? It's just kind of, I don't know, not realistic in that matter. I mean, if he was destined to get blown away, I think it would have been more fitting for him to get blown away by one of the thugs that was chasing him, or even by the Maggie character. I mean, when she goes to meet him the next day and then she realizes, maybe she found out that this guy really was an imposter, and so she gets mad and decides to kill him. I don't know, that would have been a little bit easier to take than seeing a father come and gun his own son down. It would have made a little more sense. It was just a little too strange of an ending for me.
Yeah, a spurned woman killing him would have been a little, yeah.
Yeah, or the gangsters killing him. That, you know, that would have certainly been, you know, more realistic. But
yeah,
to have his father kill him just seemed way too far out of left field. So what did you think, Ken?
I gave it a 1 rating, which is poor. The Twilight Zone formula for me, basically, you'll have a couple characters, you'll have a strange turn of events, maybe a bizarre ending, maybe not, and maybe something to keep you guessing throughout the episode. This episode, The Four of Us Are Dying, was completely all over the map. It took me into a maze. I was in complete puzzlement of what is going on. All right, he has this mystical power of changing his face into someone else. If you're watching it the first time, you're kind of impressed with his mystical powers. But to me, The Twilight Zone is not about, you know, the extraordinary talent of someone being able to change his face or to do something superhuman. To me, The Twilight Zone more is about the everyday life of somebody, and then he has a strange turn of events or bizarre, you know, something that happens in his life, and then you care about the guy, and then either you feel the sorrow or you feel his plight. This episode, the only thing I liked, obviously, was Beverly Garland, and I agree, she was wasted. She's gorgeous, but she can act, too. You know, you can feel with her whatever scene she's in. And she just had that scene with Ross Martin, you know, that character played, They have a love scene, but not really much to get involved in the scene. So I was disappointed there. And then I agree, the ending was just flat as a tire. The guy comes up, shoots him, his face turns, and then we go into the Twilight Zone, stars, and it just fades off. And so I gave it a one poor rating. And to me, the key to any story or any episode in this series is, hey, do I want to watch it again? If it's on a marathon, will I stick around and watch it even though I've seen it before? And I'm sorry to say, guys, on this episode, one viewing is enough for me. And if it comes up again and I'm flipping around the channels and I see it, I won't bother to watch it again. I have no interest. Bob, what do you think?
Well, I have a lot of problems with this episode, aside from the fact that it's just flat out boring. Is the fact, I just have one question here, and that is, if you had the ability to change faces or to become somebody else in that way, aside from the fact that obviously, like Kitty mentioned and like everybody mentioned in their reviews, you would pick somebody famous or something that would do you some good, wouldn't you do your homework about that person? Wouldn't you find out everything you could about them before you decide to look like them? Because you're taking quite a chance. You don't know what you're getting into. I mean, that's like going out in the street and just picking anybody who's walking by and saying, you know what, I think I'll be that guy. But you don't know what that guy's into. So you're buying a package you don't know. So he doesn't really do his homework at all. I mean, after he meets the girl, he goes out in the street and he says, I've never been loved like that, and so forth and so on. So I can almost understand that. But the last person, the guy whose father shoots him, he just sees his picture in the alley, so he has no choice. The middle one about the money, it just seems to me that he wasn't prepared for that. Did he really believe that he was going to walk in there and there weren't going to be some thugs chasing him? Everything he does is just stupid. Now, it's true that Serling at the beginning of the episode says that he's a small timer, so that he's really not thinking big the way most people would. But even so, it just seems to me to be ridiculous for him to not do his homework and find out everything he can about these people. Now, beyond that, this is peculiar to me, but when I watch a story, any story, I like to get involved, so I like to know about the people I'm watching. And I don't really know about any of these people at all. I don't know about this guy, Arch Hammer. When did he develop this incredible ability? Where did he get it from? Why is he using it so poorly? I don't know anything about the other characters either. And the guy, a father shooting his own son is pretty severe. I mean, I know he lists some things that he did, but that seems extremely severe to me, that he would take out a gun and blow him away. So the whole thing seems pointless to me. And I agree with Ken that it's one of those stories that's so unpleasant you really never want to watch it again. Because with classic Twilight Zone episodes, every time you watch it in the future, even if you've seen it 10 times, like everybody has seen Time Enough at Last countless times, you always get something new out of it. You always get a little different take on it. And the story like this, you get nothing out of it. You get nothing out of it the first time. You get nothing out of it the 10th time. It just kind of lays there. Ken, doesn't seem like to you like it's just filler, really.
Yeah, it's there's too many characters involved. You know, you can't do that to an audience. I mean, how many people are we talking about? Four people, plus the girl, plus the thugs, plus the father in the end. I mean, you've got 10 different people. You can't do that in a 30-minute episode.
And you get no background on any of them. You get absolutely no background.
And worse than that, there's nobody to like.
None.
Well, I didn't like anybody.
How about Beverly Garland?
Yeah, but she seems a little like a floozy to me. I didn't. I don't think she was worth dying.
Well, the one thing about the Maggie character, though, is that I don't think she's really given enough screen time to where you really can feel that much for her.
Well, the whole point of the episode simply seems to be to show that this guy can change his face. But if that is indeed the whole point, and they don't really want to do any character development, I have to feel in my own mind that there's a reason why a man would do this, and he seems to have no reason. And when we first see him, he's shaving in the mirror and he changes his face, and I'm thinking to myself, wow, that's quite an achievement. I wonder how it is you came to do that. I was just curious to know, was he born? And if and he's like a middle-aged man. So didn't you find it kind of strange? Did he know this all of his life? And how come he hasn't used it before, or has he? Wouldn't you like to know if he used it when he was in school or anything?
Yeah, why isn't he rich by now?
That's what I'm saying. I mean, it's not like did he wake up overnight and all of a sudden it happened to him? Or did he was he like this as a kid? Because if he was, he should be a rich man by now. What's he trying for? He's such a small timer, and he's trying for so little that it's not particularly involving, and that's the problem with it. But you know, curiously enough, even though the story is lousy, it's got some quality actors in it. It really does.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
A lot of those actors were in TV at that time, and nobody gets to do a whole lot, but you know, they do what they can with the part that they're given.
Well, Ross Martin was a good actor. Ross Martin was a very good actor.
Well, I think they all are. I think everybody you saw in this story, for that time, in 1959, were all good actors, and they did a good job on it, but they really weren't given much to play around with. So
yeah.
It's just a poor episode. And I know Ken said something in his review about they shouldn't be doing a story like this early in the series. I know that means a lot to you, Ken, does it not?
Yeah, I was thinking by, you know, reviewing it, and I have the book on the Twilight Zone. I read some of the comments there. You know, would you be amazed that some people in the book, in the studios, loved the episode? And I was thinking, to me, what could they have done with this story to make me like it even better? I mean, you guys have any ideas of how the story could have been improved upon?
Well, a little more background in the characters,
yeah.
Definitely.
Well, yeah, I mean, and then just the ending. I mean, like I said, it would have made a lot more sense if his character was destined to be blown away at the end. It would have made a lot more sense to have it be either the gangsters or Maggie do it, you know, not to have his father. I mean, come on, Ken, you got three sons. I mean, can you think of anything that any of them would do to make you want to go take a gun and blow any of them away?
Oh, he's probably thought that many times over his lifetime.
Never.
I mean, even you see it where convicted murderers, you know, you see their parents standing there behind them. So it's like, what did this guy do to make his father this pissed off at him? I mean, this was severe.
The only way to make this episode worse for me is to have more love scenes with Beverly Garland. And then I'll give it a 3 rating or a 4 rating, and that's all.
You know what? You did the same thing with The Fugitive. Every time a woman shows up, you lose your mind, and you want to turn it into some X-rated movie or something. I don't know what's with you.
I think Beverly Garland should have blown him away. I think Maggie should have blown him away.
Just do me one favor. If you're going to change the episode, don't turn it into an hour. That's all I know.
Just have Beverly Garland blow him away right at the very beginning.
All right, well, I've got everybody gave it a pretty poor rating. Well, Kitty gave it a 2, which is pretty low for her because she usually goes higher than that. I gave it a 1, but I have no idea why. I don't know what I saw in it when I first watched it to give it a 1 rating, because at the moment, I can't think of anything that recommends it.
I think so, I gave it a 0. I think I gave
I know,
it a 0.
I really should have landed with you, yeah, because it's just a very, very poor episode.
Hey, if I could
but,
change my face, I'd change into Catherine Zeta-Jones. I'm not wasting my time with thugs.
You know, we were thinking that too, especially Ken.
Ken, change your face into Catherine Zeta-Jones. There you go.
Oh, she's gorgeous.
I know. I'd change my face into her in a second.
Listen, if you're going to let Ken run down all the women in The Twilight Zone and The Fugitive if he likes, we're never going to get to the second episode tonight.
All right, let's get to the second
yeah,
episode.
Yeah, I think we've trampled this one to death. Okay, 2 weeks from today on Saturday, November 21st, at this same time of day, we will be back to review and discuss a true Twilight Zone classic. In fact, I personally think it's one of the most frightening and disturbing TV episodes ever filmed. There figures to be little, if any, disagreement over episode number 16, from January 1960, The Hitchhiker. The late actress Inger Stevens portrays a woman traveling alone across the country by car. No problems until, that is, she sees a hitchhiker by the side of the road with his thumb out. Well, still no problems. Just do what your mother probably told you to do when you first started to drive. Don't pick up this guy or anybody and let them in your car. The problem is that mom never told you what to do if he keeps somehow, some way getting ahead of you. and is still asking for a ride. Be with us 2 weeks from today to find out just what happens in The Hitchhiker. Now let us move on to our next episode up for review today, and for a summary and her review of episode number 14, Third from the Sun, we turn to our other lovely co-host, Kitty. Kitty, take it away.
Okay, thanks, Bob. Well, first and foremost, I'll tell you my summaries are not quite as detailed as Lynn's, but hopefully you'll still get the idea of it. This is actually, I know that not, you know, my co-host didn't particularly care for this episode, but I liked it, and it's one I've actually always liked. I remember the first time I saw it as a teenager, I liked it. You start off by seeing what appears to be some type of a manufacturing plant, and it becomes evident that they're manufacturing, it's like a weapons manufacturing plant or a plant that's experimenting with different kinds of ways of machines of new transportation. But we get this guy coming out, and it's a very, very hot day. And his boss comes out, and they have a conversation, and it's very evident that things in the world are very tense. It's actually, to me, it's kind of a very poignant episode from the standpoint that at that particular time, that was during the start of the nuclear arms race. People were starting to build bomb shelters in their backyards, and nuclear war was actually a very real fear for a lot of people. Not that it's not a real fear today, but I think we've been living with it for so long, it doesn't seem quite as scary as it maybe did back then. And the one guy knows that a nuclear war is coming, and it means that pretty much everybody's going to be dead. The world is going to destroy itself. He goes home from work, and he basically he talks to his friend who also works at this plant, and his friend says that, yes, we've got the vehicle to be able to leave, so we got to do it. It's a space vehicle. It's the prototype. They're not entirely sure that it's going to be able to take them as far away as they need to be taken away from, but they are willing to give it a try because they know that in the next couple of days, it's all going to be gone. And you see him with his wife and his teenage daughter. He tells his teenage daughter that she needs to stay home that night. The couple comes over. And eventually the boss comes over. The boss knows that things are not what they appear to be, that this guy is up to something. In fact, you even saw the boss spying on him and his friend at one point. And basically the boss leaves, and then they leave. They get in the car, and we get back to the plant, and we have this little showdown with the boss, but they all eventually manage to get into this flying saucer contraption that takes them out, and they're having a conversation saying, do you know what the name of this place is that we're going? And they says, yes, it's called Earth, and it's very similar to where we live. And so it was a nice little shocking twist there at the end. I remember when I saw it as a kid. And I liked it. I thought it was an interesting episode. Certainly something that you could see playing out on Earth. Something, though, that Bob, I remember, mentioned was at the end was they didn't talk about what happens after they land on Earth. I mean, with as paranoid of people as we are, if somebody came crashing down to Earth in a flying saucer, what would the reaction be? Would it be friendly or hostile? Or would we just put them in a zoo like in that episode, people are alike all over. Who knows? But I still liked it. I gave it a 4 rating. What do you think, Lynn?
Well, I actually hated this episode. I know
y'all hated it.
I know. It was too slow moving for me. It bored me. I thought Fritz Weaver, one of the actors in it, I've always admired him. I think Fritz Weaver is a wonderful actor. And he was very good in this role, but overall, for me, it was just too slow-moving, too boring. It was just, I don't know. I thought it was a little bit of overacting, all the nervousness that they showed. Like when the boss comes into their house and they're playing cards and they're sitting there and the woman comes out, the wife, Fritz Weaver's wife, comes out with the lemonade and she's shaking like a leaf. Now, of course, that's going to, you know, naturally pique the boss's curiosity. What are you doing? You know, what's going on? And he did mention it. He says, "Yo, you seem a little nervous tonight," you know. And everything they did was a little bit of overacting where, you know, if you're four people and you're trying to plot this this grand plan to get out of this planet and get on a spaceship and go to another planet, you try to be a little cooler about it. And they were not cool at all. They acted nervous. They acted very jumpy. And the whole thing for me just didn't work. The whole thing was ridiculous. And plus, when they went to go onto the spaceship, you know, they're beating up these big, huge guards. You know, these guards are watching the spaceship, and you know, in one punch they knock out these guards, and they have you know, guns. These guys have guns, and it's like, what's going on here? You know, why aren't they pulling their guns? Why are these guards being overwhelmed like this? The whole thing just didn't work for me. You know, so I just hated the episode. I really did. But Ken, what do you think?
I gave it a zero rating. I'm very picky when I watch television series. You know me. If I'm going to work all day in my business and come home and sit on the couch and put my feet up on the chair and, you know, get a cold one in my hand and have my dog at my side. And
yeah, are you telling us that you drink beer?
No, I said a cold one, a cold Coke. Coca-Cola Classic.
A Coke, okay. Right. When you said a cold one, I just was thinking, he comes home and grabs a beer? No, that doesn't seem like Ken.
Well, not during the work week, no. I'll have a Coke in the evening. But
okay.
I have to get my dog next to my side, and we're going to turn on the Twilight Zone and the opening scenes, and here we have the space program again. Okay, Rod Serling, you are really overemphasizing the space and flying saucers and other planets. So here we go again. And I agree with Lynn. The opening or the first act was boring. I mean, what's going on? These people are talking to each other. They're nervous. Play some cards. I did like the lemonade, and I did like the cake, or was it cookies? I forgot what it was.
It was cake. Cake.
Oh, I'd like to have a piece of that cake, so that got my interest. But other than that, I'm kind of, you know, watching, falling asleep a little bit. Then the second act comes in, and this creepy character with the glasses, you know, he's kind of spying on them, and he's kind of strange. Then the family, the daughter was kind of obnoxious. I didn't like her at all. Actually, she should have gone out on that date. Get away from your parents. What are you doing there? So that annoyed me. And then, you know, the build-up scene. Okay, here we go. So they have a flying saucer. Okay, there must be a hint there a little bit. A flying saucer, that's what the UFOs are, right? That's what we've been studying on Earth for the past 100 years. So Rod Serling puts in the script a flying saucer. So they get in. Okay, they overtake the guy, or overtake the guards. Pretty strange scene there. I would think the guards have the guns and the rifles, but this family manages to overtake them, take them down, get into the spacecraft. It takes off. All right, something's going to happen, but nothing happens. They say they're going to Earth, and then Rod Serling gets on the narration and the end of the episode. And I look at my dog and I said, what was that? So, Bob, help me out. Did you get something from this story?
You know what? After that heartwarming story about Ken and his dog Bozo and that classic Coke, I'm not sure I can say anything that counts at this point. I got tears running down my face at the moment. So let me dry out and just say this. I hated The Four of Us Are Dying, but this story absolutely infuriates me, and I'll tell you why. Because if there's anything that makes me mad, it's when you have something that's full of potential and you do absolutely nothing with it. This is really a great story, but they don't do anything with it. You know why? Because they're so busy and so eager to get to the twist ending, that they don't put anything in front of it. It's all about the ending. It's all about, oh my goodness, so they're really not Earthlings, they're coming to Earth. Isn't that something? Well, isn't that boring? I mean, and there are so many, I don't know, you know, we may have to be here 2 hours for me to do all this. But let me just say, from the very beginning, I'd like to know why that family is so calm. I think Kitty mentioned that they were nervous or whatever. Somebody mentioned it, and it didn't look like that to me. I thought that they should be in a real panic over the fact that the world's about to end. Because I'm the oldest one here, and I lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis in 1962, which was 3 years after this episode was filmed and presented on TV. And I was a teenager, and I was really terrified because they were saying on the news that this might be it, that we really might blow up the world. And I wasn't just sitting around having iced tea or whatever. I was asking my father why he did not build a fallout shelter in the basement like everybody else around the country had done, and now we were all going to get incinerated. So they weren't nearly as upset as I expected them to be. They were way too calm about the entire thing. Well, we'll get out of it. And then we got absolutely no background at all. Why is the world coming to an end? Who decided that this was going to happen, and why is it they know about it? Wouldn't you think that would be a secret or something? If they work in a munitions plant, what in the world is in that plant that would ever allow them to be in on the knowledge that we're going to start launching missiles? And the United States doesn't do that. We're not a country who does that. We don't simply launch missiles one day because we feel like doing it. So somebody must be doing it to us, or there must be a war on. But how would we know, since we're not given any background at all? So it's all about getting them past this guy who's onto them and getting them into this spaceship. I said in my review that the whole episode looks like it was filmed in Rod Serling's basement. It just doesn't look very good. And they all get in a spaceship that, frankly, is no bigger than the one I got out of the cereal box when I was a kid. So I don't know how they all got in there. They're going to escape that way. Now, Kelly has already mentioned the problem about, and so has Ken, about them coming to Earth and not getting a good greeting. I got news for you. They're going to get blown right out of the sky. They have no chance at all of landing on Earth. I mean, as soon as we see them, it's 1959. We're convinced that the Russians are going to attack us any day now. All we need to do is see a spaceship landing, and that will do it right there. And the great irony is that they're trying to escape a war and the end of the world. They're going to precipitate a war and the end of the world. That's how bad it is.
I remember one funny comment that you made in your review of this episode. You said it's easier to steal a car than it is to
So they get there, and there's this apparently the only spaceship they have ready, which is strange.
Mm-hmm.
And it's simply sitting in the middle. There's hardly any lights on it at all. There's two guards, and all you got to do is break the lock on the fence.
Yeah, and said it's easier to steal a spaceship than it is to steal a car.
Yes, and somehow they seem to have keys to the ignition because they were able to get away.
Oh, don't you know? I mean, they know how to hotwire it.
Oh, is that what it is? I was watching how he did it. Because when we send a space shuttle up, we go through all this trouble, and we got thousands working behind the scenes. And we have a countdown and everything. They just get in there and go, okay, did you check the oil? Let's get out of here. And before you know it, they're heading for Earth. Now, the other problem I have with it is that I assume at the end of this story, since we get this big build-up that they thought they were getting away, but they're coming to Earth where the same kind of thing is happening. No, it's not. I didn't feel bad for them at all because in their planet – they have actually decided to end the world, but they're coming here. We haven't made any such decision yet. Oh, sure, we're living under the threat of it, but we haven't decided. So they're going to do pretty good. Actually, they did escape. It makes it seem like, wait till they find out where they're going. They're going to land and go, where? On Earth? You have nuclear weapons, too? Yeah, but unlike you, we didn't decide to use them. That's the difference. So I don't feel sorry for them in any way. So the whole story has a lot of potential, but it isn't really developed into anything meaningful. And that's the kind of story, those kind of stories make me even, I think that The Four of Us Are Dying has nothing. You can run that for 3 hours, it's going to go nowhere. But this story might have actually gone with a little background and a little attention to detail. it might have been better. Was anybody onto this from the very beginning? Because it's called Third from the Sun, did anybody already know what the ending was going to be?
No, I didn't.
Well, no, because, Bob, they didn't put they don't put the name of the episode at the beginning. So we don't.
Is that right? Is that true?
Yeah.
You know, that's a good point. I never thought about that. So we're doing it in 2020 hindsight. That's interesting.
Yeah.
Yeah, you're right about that. When I think back to when it was on TV originally, I don't think any titles. You know, I've never thought about that. That's interesting. Okay, so if that's true, then you're right. There would be no way to know that.
Yeah.
But,
I never thought about that either. I didn't realize that the show was in the opening.
So what was Rod Serling? What was the main point of the episode beside the characters acting their lines out and then making the getaway? What do you think Rod Serling was trying to convey to the audience watching? Just that surprise twist ending?
No, I think
what he was trying to convey was that he was trying to say, be careful because this could happen to us, and in our case, nobody's going to get out.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was the point, and also probably simply saying that there are maybe other civilizations out there. We always think of other civilizations as being far advanced from what we are. They don't have any wars. They've cured all the diseases. It's utopia. It's fabulous. But they may have the same problems we have.
So maybe his point was grass is always greener on the other side?
I suppose, but I still find the whole thing is just there's a lot of potential there, but it simply doesn't go anywhere. And that family should have been a lot more frantic than they were.
Mm-hmm.
And it seems too easy. It seems too easy for them to get away because they really aren't living in an advanced civilization since it looks just like Earth. And they're driving a car. I thought it was kind of funny. During the story, they used the odd camera angles to kind of throw us off base here. Are they really on Earth? Are they really like us? Why they're driving a funny kind of car? We don't really get to see it. But that, you know, none of that really added up. I want to know from Ken, what did your dog think about it? Because I know he reviews things.
Well, if my dog moans and groans, he'll give it a poor rating. But
really?
If my dog wags the tail and is very jumpy, he'll like the episode. So,
wow.
But let me ask you, don't you think Rod Serling is kind of going overboard with the space concept? Because, come on, we've seen Where Is Everybody? That was space. The Lonely, that is space. And When the Sky Was Opened, that was space. Third from the Sun. So we've got, like in the first 14 episodes, he's got the theme of space. Don't you think?
Well, I was going to say, well, get used to it, Ken, because there's a lot more of them out there.
Yeah, I know. I know.
Well, space was very much in the news then, so I don't know that I'm really all of a sudden surprised. But don't blame Rod Serling for this. It wasn't written by him. It was written by Richard Matheson. And everybody thinks the world of Richard Matheson, who's, been around forever. He's 83 years old now, and he's got the three stories coming out in the movies.
Yeah, he's still
and
writing.
Yeah. Yes, it's amazing. And he did write some classic episodes. So, even a classic writer like Richard Matheson, of course, I don't know how much it was changed for TV. You never know that. A writer writes a story, they can completely screw it up and change it. And it may not. I've never read the, if indeed it was a short story, and I don't know whether he wrote it directly for the series or not, whether it was any different, because in a story you can flesh out the characters and you can make it a little deeper than it is. But I'm just really put upon by the fact that I like the basic story. Gee, what would happen if there was a terrible war or you were up against it and you had the opportunity to get away? Where would you go, and would you consider the dangers involved in it, or would you be so desperate to get away you wouldn't care? Because they're going to another planet, and they don't really – I know the guy says they're just like us, it's called Earth, blah, 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 but you don't really know what you're going to find when you get there. So it's one of those stories that really literally goes nowhere.
The case with that family. They were going into it blind, and they just had optimism, and it was a blind optimism.
Yeah. Okay. Well, it seems that we've done everything we could to trash the memory of the Twilight Zone today.
I don't care, Bob. I like this show. No, I like this episode.
Forgot. You gave it an excellent rating. We'll just leave it at that. that's what we do here. We tell the truth. We're not just a fan club, except when it is deserved. Trust me, there will be many times when we will go on and on and on about how good everything is, and one of those times will be in 2 weeks when we do The Hitchhiker, about as different a story from these two as you could ever hope for. So, my personal thanks to Kitty and Lynn and Ken for their contributions to this, our first program on Talk Shoe, and a special thanks to our listeners. We hope to see you here often. You have been listening to Talking Twilight Zone on Talk Shoe. Okay, Lynn, why don't you play us out of here?
Okay, we'll see you in 2 weeks, and we hope you enjoyed the show.